Citizen Kane was knocked from the number one spot on an industry list of the greatest films of all time and replaced with the Alfred Hitchcock thriller, Vertigo. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you think Vertigo is the greatest film of all time? Better than Citizen Kane? Is there another film that deserves this distinction as far as you're concerned? We will talk about the recently released Greatest Films of All Time list from the Sight and Sound magazine, and we will welcome your nominations for the best films ever at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dana Polan. He is a professor of cinema studies at New York University. He voted in the last Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll in 2002. And last but not least, he was my producer Amanda Magnus's professor. And she saw most of these films on the top 10 list because of that class. Professor Polan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So tell us about this Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll that that you once voted in.
Well, I can give you a little bit of the history. Sight and Sound is a British magazine. It's run by the British Film Institute. And in the 1950s, and interestingly, the idea was to give the journal a little bit of hipness. They decided to do a poll every 10 years. And I say it's interesting because now a lot of people think there's a kind of stodginess to Sight and Sound or to the polling, the polling and the way it's become kind of dogmatized or canonized. But anyway, starting in the 50s, they would do this poll of critics, of writers on film. Eventually, they started doing a parallel poll that was asking directors. And so it's every 10 years. And films have gone up and down in the poll. Some films have stayed on the list. Some films have moved in position. There have been some surprises. There have been some perennial classics that stay on the list or seem to stay on the list. I think Citizen Kane was one that a lot of people were surprised got knocked off. So it's been going on. The number of critics involved has expanded. The rules have slightly changed or have changed, actually, I think, in a fairly consequential way, and we can talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what is the criteria. What is being voted on? What is considered a great movie?
Yeah, well, that's, I think, the big ambiguity of this poll, and it's probably the big ambiguity of lots of polls. What do we mean by great? Because great can mean the film that for you was the greatest, for whatever reason. It could be that you really like action films, and this a certain film incarnates the action film. Or it can be you are interested in the art of cinema, and a certain film seems to extend the art of cinema or show new possibilities. So greatness is itself, I think, a kind of variable term. And you see that even in the way Sight and Sound currently invites its critics to vote. And that's what I was talking about, a change. When I voted in 2002, they simply said, please send in your list of great films. I sent in 10 films that were the films that had been important to me, that I thought were important in film history, and they rejected my list, saying, no, we weren't interested in your personal choices. We want the films that you objectively think everyone would agree has contributed to the art of cinema. And the way they put it now, they now sort of are allowing the personal favorites. Their current criteria, they say, you know, select 10 films. And they then go on to say, quote, you might choose the 10 films you feel are most important to film history, or the 10 the 10 that are most important to film history. And that doesn't necessarily mean you think they're your personal favorites, or the 10 that represent the aesthetic pinnacles of achievement in film art, or the 10 films that have had the biggest impact on your own view of cinema. So the first criteria is sort of asking for something objective or that claims to be objective. What are the 10 films that have contributed to film history? The last is, which are the ones that have had the biggest impact on your own view of cinema? And it might be that you think of cinema in terms of entertainment, or in terms of film art, or in terms of action, or any number of criteria. So I think there's a kind of ambiguity in the very way the poll is structured.
Yeah, and that is a significant change. I guess you should have been voting this time around.
Maybe, yes.
That's interesting. Well, I'm going to ask you too some of your important films that you did think ought to be on this list. But let's get your reaction first to Vertigo, knocking Citizen Kane from the number one spot. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I think there's two things there. One is Citizen Kane being knocked off the list by whatever. It could have been Vertigo. It could have been perhaps something else. There's a certain sense in which one expected Citizen Kane to be there always. Then I think that's a little different from the question of Vertigo moving into the number one slot. Hitchcock's been moving up. One of the ironies is Sight and Sound through the 60s was generally very dismissive of Hitchcock. Sight and Sound not merely was stodgy, but had a certain high art notion of cinema. Cinema should be uplifting, should be moral. And one can now make the argument that Hitchcock participates in a kind of high art cinema. But in the 50s and 60s, he was seen as an entertainer. He was seen more as a purveyor of easy emotions or suspense or thrills and chills, but not a deep cinema. And when the first major book on Hitchcock came out in the 60s by a man named Robin Wood, he was particularly taking Sight and Sound to task, and he quotes them a lot, sort of saying they don't get Hitchcock. They don't get how he's an important moral artist. So the irony that Vertigo, by a director dismissed by Sight and Sound, is now at the top of the Sight and Sound list. It's a very strong irony.
It is interesting. We did have some comments on Facebook. Somebody said, Vertigo is a great movie, but greatest of all time, And others who said it's not even the greatest Hitchcock movie. And this is all very subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is subjective. I mean, Vertigo has gained in reputation over time, and that can happen with a film that deserves its reputation. It might not get it at first. I think Vertigo, it's been a real battle, and I think there are a lot of people who, when they watch it, find numerous flaws. I mean, to speak personally, I am not one of the people who is convinced that Kim Novak is good in the film. There are those who go crazy over her performance, say that her kind of zombie-like presentation in the film fits the ghost-like character she's portraying. I just don't think of Kim Novak. I've never thought of her as a good actress in Hollywood, and I think she's, for me, always been a kind of fatal flaw in the film. But it's always also been interesting to me that others try and defend her.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about Citizen Kane and why it has been in the number one spot for 50 years. What makes Citizen Kane so great?
Well, I think, there's two different questions. One is, what's great about Citizen Kane? And that's maybe a little different than why it stayed in the number one spot. I think sometimes when canons get created, there's a kind of dogmatism or things get frozen. There becomes a kind of dogma that we can't change this, that this is a given. I think you see this in other fields of the arts where if something is said to be great, there's often a sense that this can't be challenged. So, for example, I was trying to think of a comparison to literature. It would be like if one year some poll said Oscar Wilde is the greatest English dramatist and not Shakespeare. You know, that would create scandals and ripples through all of literary study. And there's a way in which the dominance of Shakespeare is not questionable or is not to be questioned. And I think there's some of that with Citizen Kane, that once it got decided that it was the great film, and there's lots of reasons that contribute to that beyond the film itself, the story of its director, that here's this young man showing so much potential, and then immediately after Citizen Kane, well, actually before Citizen Kane and through Citizen Kane, but especially afterwards, there's all this studio interference. It creates a mythology of the romantic artist bucking the system. I think there's ways in which, within the film, the fact that it's so experimental for its time, anything from the flashback structure to the fact that different people see different characters in the film see his story in different ways, all of this contributes to the aura that the film has. And in terms of influence, the complicated time structure, the relativity of trying to get at the truth of this man, Charles Foster Kane, all of those have been very influential. You know, and I think that's another criteria that Sight and Sound goes on. Not merely is the film great in itself, but has its impact been great, including its impact on other films. So, for example, The Searchers, the John Ford film, which has been on the list, part of its impact is that other directors are constantly referring back to The Searchers. So Taxi Driver, which has made it on the list in previous decades, Taxi Driver borrows certain images or certain themes from The Searchers, and that's part of the importance of The Searchers.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dana Polan, who is a professor of cinema studies at New York University. We are talking about the recently released Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time list, which has 50 films on it in total. But one of the big news stories from this list is that Vertigo took the number one spot over Citizen Kane. And we are welcoming your thoughts, your nominations for the greatest film of all time. What is it in your opinion and why? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The theme to the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. It is on the top 10 list of the greatest films of all time, number 6 on the list this year. We are talking about the greatest films of all time, according to Sight and Sound, and we're welcoming your nominations at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dana Polan, who is a professor of cinema studies at New York University. He voted in the last Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll back in 2002. This poll is taken once a decade, and one of the things it seeks to do is to name the greatest film of all time. But there are, as I said, it looks like about 50 on this list. So, Professor Polan, 2001, A Space Odyssey, is that a film that you would have in the top 10?
I would, again, say that the criteria, it depends on what one means by great. I think 2001 is an incredibly important film in the history of cinema. It does new things with genre. It takes the science fiction film in a direction it's never been. I think it does certain things with narrative and metaphysics that had not been done in cinema before. I think it experiments with time and duration in ways that have never been done before. So it's an incredibly important film. I think it's, for a lot of people, it's not an easily watchable film precisely because it is about slow duration, things unfold at a very slow rate, and then there are other moments that speed up. You jump from prehistoric times to modern times. It's a very ambitious film, and it's not for everyone, but it's certainly incredibly important within the history of cinema.
It's interesting, too. It seems to be one of the more modern films on this list. It was made in 1968, but and while there are a few newer ones on here, for the most part, these seem to be, you know, classics from way back when. Is there something to be said about needing to be, I don't know, it has to have been made a long time ago in order to be on this list?
Well, what's interesting is if you look at the polls in the first decades, 52, 62, et cetera, the film, there are, for example, in 52, there are a number of silent films, so 30, 40 years earlier. But there are also films from just a couple years before. And there is a sense of trying to capture the vibrance, the energy of film culture as it's happening at the moment. So when Bicycle Thieves is on, I think, number one in 1952, it's a very recent film. Now, part of what's happened, I think, in film culture is that a lot of critics have found the last few decades of cinema, with some exceptions and important exceptions, have found it less interesting than the previous history of cinema, so that the bias is towards older films. And there's a sense increasingly that, especially with Hollywood films, many Hollywood films, although they may look virtuoso at first, you probably need to give them time to see how they look 10 years later. You know, Inception was a big hit film a couple years ago. Lots of people thought it was very metaphysical, very arty. And I think inception might look different 10 years from now. So there's a sense that we need a certain critical distance. You know, a lot of the films, American films that got acclaimed, were from a period around 1972 to 75. And there's been this long-running mythology that that's a kind of golden age of post-Hollywood American filmmaking, people like Scorsese with Taxi Driver getting on the list, or Coppola with The Godfather, or Coppola with Godfather 2, or Coppola with Apocalypse Now. So there's a sense that we need time, that American cinema is often fad-driven, so we need time to see which really are the classics of American film. So I think there's a number of things going on. Now, one of the things that's interesting is there's the director's poll this year, whereas the critics poll, somewhere on the list, I think number 28 and somewhere else, are films post the year 2000. None of the directors picked films post year 2000. Oh. They all went for more classic films. So they're not voting for films of their colleagues. They're voting for older directors.
Interesting. Well, we have lots of nominations lining up. Great. So let's talk first to Jordan in Oshkosh. Hi, Jordan. What do you think is the greatest film of all time?
Hi. Well, my personal favorite that I have seen multiple times is the 1993 film Schindler's List. And now, I know the person you're interviewing, the professor, you're stating how most films, they need time in the public eye for a decade or so, to really see how truly amazing they are. And I mean, I'm looking at the Sight and Sound list, and on the director's list, I noticed, like, the film The Godfather, it's not there. But on the critics list, it's not on the list, which is truly amazing to me. I feel like they're looking at films that, yes, they have a certain aspect where they're truly making cinema gold, and most directors now are somewhat referring back to those films, taking certain aspects from those films, and then incorporating them into the films they are creating now. However, I feel that a great film shouldn't just be looked at for a little incident of what the film created. It should be looked at overall as a whole. I know Vertigo, I believe in the opening scene, that has a very historical shot, where it's the first time anyone's ever seen a vertical down shot, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I just feel like a great film shouldn't be judged on just how influential it is to directors, but just how influential it is to a culture.
All right. Professor Pullen?
I think there's a lot of really interesting things in what you were saying. First of all, that we need to judge not only the virtuoso moments in films or the standout moments, although that's often the way certain films are talked about. So Vertigo is, I think, for the critics that really, really like it, for example, Robin Wood in the book I was mentioning before in the 60s, they talk about the film as a whole, but it's also clear that there are these exceptional sequences, and that's sometimes what stands out, maybe to the detriment of thinking of the film as a whole. I think your comments on Coppola and The Godfather are very interesting. It's, again, directors voting for or not voting for other directors. And Coppola, I think, himself has had a kind of up-and-down fate in the director's community. There was a moment where he was very, very respected, and then a lot of directors, I think, felt he either didn't fulfill his promise or took a wrong turn. And there's almost a way in which they're trying to avoid a reference to Coppola. I also found it interesting that when you started, you said not the greatest film is Schindler's List, but my personal favorite. And I think that's probably often a better way to put things. I mean, for example, I would not say that Schindler's List is one of my personal favorites, but I'd be willing to argue why it's not, and I'd be willing to hear you argue why it is. I think the problem with something like this, the problem that can happen with a poll, is it becomes a kind of dogma where it's these are the greatest films, and if you haven't seen these, you need to, or if you haven't seen them, there's something wrong with you, or if you have seen them but haven't realized their greatness, there's definitely something wrong with you. And those kind of dogmas I'm very wary of.
So do I have to see Tokyo Story? I have not seen that.
There are many things one has to do in one's life. It'd probably be not a bad thing to do, but make choices.
That's number three on the list.
Yep.
And I have to admit that I've seen many, many movies on this top 50, but there are more than I care to admit that I have not seen on the top 10.
And so. One of the things I should point out is that what's printed and what's published are the top 50. There's also each critic's individual choices. And when you add up the individual choices, over 1,000 films got a nomination. They got at least one vote. So we're talking we're talking about a broad swath of films, not just 50 films. The 50 are the ones that got the most votes, but critics thought there were 1,000 films worthy of mention.
Yeah, that's right. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dana Polin, a professor of cinema studies at New York University. We are talking about the recently released Sight and Sound list of the greatest films of all time, and we're welcoming your questions. We're also welcoming your nominations, and maybe we should say, what is your favorite movie of all time? Do you think it is one of the greatest films of all time? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Dave in Appleton is with us next. Hello, Dave.
Hi. I am inclined to agree with your guest. I do believe it's kind of a misnomer between greatest and best. It's completely relative. For me personally, The Empire Strikes Back, because I was born in 1977, is one of my greatest, most favorite films of all time. It has everything that a sci-fi person, a sci-fi fan like myself would want, because it's got a great storyline, a great score, great action sequences. And it's better than Star Wars, and it's better than Return of the Jedi. It's kind of like The Godfather 2 in that relative frame. Everything about the movie is great, and that's one of the reasons that I would nominate it if I had the choice to nominate it on this list.
Interesting. I thought Star Wars came out in 1977, Dave, not to split hairs.
I was born in 77. I saw Empire Strikes Back in 80.
All right. Yeah, that's I'm
you
still
were 3 years old?
Yeah, that was the first movie I ever saw.
That's funny. Yeah, well, super.
I think the thing that was interesting in what you said was you started by saying it had everything that a sci-fi, I forget exactly how you said it, but something like it had everything in it that a sci-fi person would want. And I think often when we talk about the greatest film, we're really talking about our favorite film, and it's favorite insofar as it meets certain criteria that we personally hold. So, for example, if, to go back to an example I used before, if we really like action movies, then we might say a certain film is the greatest because it's an action movie that gives us all the thrills of an action movie. So, for example, even though I'm a film scholar, I have a very great fondness for Die Hard, which no person would ever think of as the greatest film, but it is one of my favorite films because some part of me does very much like action films, and I think it gives you many of the things you want in an action film. You know, it's like when people talk about, when scholars or critics say The Sopranos is the best thing on TV, it's the best thing on TV if your criteria are for things like The Sopranos. But if you, let's suppose you like baseball on TV, then The Sopranos might not be the best thing ever. So it does depend on what your personal criteria are, what you sense are the important factors. I would say that the Sight and Sound list represents some of the favorite films for people who study film and who know film history, and that's not everybody else.
It's interesting. I do not see The Wizard of Oz, and that happened to be one of my, I guess, favorite movies of all time. I grew up with the movie. I thought it was, I put it on the play in grade school because I was so enthralled with that story. And I've seen some critics say, hey, it was, it was groundbreaking in many ways with the color and all that kind of stuff.
I think one could argue the importance of The Wizard of Oz in lots and lots of ways, just as one could argue the importance of a number of other Hollywood films. And here I would say that one thing we see looking at the Sight and Sound list, and we even see this if we go back to previous decades, is it's not so much that it's anti-Hollywood, it's sort of not that interested in Hollywood cinema, or not that interested in a classic Hollywood cinema, say from the 30s to the breakup of the old studios. You know, in various polls over the decades, Singing in the Rain got on the list, but I think that's in part because it's a kind of meta film that's not just a Hollywood film, it's a Hollywood film about Hollywood. But you don't find Howard Hawks films often on the list. You don't find Bring It Baby, or to use the example of The Wizard of Oz, you don't find other films from 1939, Gone with the Wind, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You don't find Casablanca on the Sight and Sound list, whereas I think it tops the AFI list or comes pretty close to the top of the AFI list. So Sight and Sound is a British publication. It's trying to represent certain notions of high art that are alternatives to Hollywood. So most Hollywood films don't get on the list. And if Vertigo gets on the list, there's a sense in which it's the un-Hollywood Hitchcock film. It's much more dreamlike. It's much more meandering. It doesn't give typical Hollywood film pleasures.
Let's go now to Terry in Green Lake. Hello, Terry.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your nomination?
I'd like Seven Beauties by Lena Wertmuller, and I don't know if it's ever been on anybody's list, but it's a wonderful film.
What is it about, and why do you love it?
I love it because it's about the Seven Beauties are the sisters of a guy who gets drafted into the Italian army and is worried about his sisters back home. I guess the father is dead, as I recall, and he's the head of the family. And so he goes AWOL from the Italian army and gets arrested, picked up by the German army, and ends up in a German prison camp. But the best part about it, I think, is the first 5 minutes, which is black and white war scenes where some men are blowing up other men and dropping bombs on them, and there's just a sort of repetitive music theme sort of saying, oh yeah, oh yeah, and it just sort of capsulizes how willing and how routine it has become for us to accept that other people will blow other people up. And like happened in Pakistan today, they took these people off the bus, figured out which ones were Sunnis or which weren't Sunnis, and shot them. So that it's just substantively the only thing that I can say that has to do with anything modern is there's a scene in Pulp Fiction, I don't know if people remember it, where the gun goes off accidentally in the back of a taxi cab. There's a scene in Seven Beauties where a similar thing happens. Someone gets killed accidentally.
Yeah.
But it's very enlightening film.
The content of the film or the message of the film, Professor Pullen?
Yeah, I think that's also very important to the notion of how a film can be great. A film can be great because it plays with the expressive possibilities of cinema. And Seven Beauties, as the caller pointed out, does do that. It plays on the distinction between black and white and color, which interestingly is something that another film that was cited, Schindler's List, does. It's also something that The Wizard of Oz does. They're playing with film form, and they're playing with the tension between black and white and color. But as the caller pointed out, in Seven Beauties, it's also in the service of a kind of serious social message, a commentary on war. And the film was acclaimed at the time for that, and in the moment when Seven Beauties came out, and I believe it was even nominated for Best Foreign Picture, it was quite acclaimed. I think it is a film whose reputation has suffered over time. I don't think that's a deserved reputation, but Lena Wertmuller, the memory of her has sort of declined. The one thing I would point out, and the caller made me think of this, it's interesting if you look at the changes in the sight and sound list over the decades, the choice of films has become much more about serious films. There are not comedies on the list. I mean, there are comic elements in some of the films, whereas in previous polls, more comic films were included, especially silent comedy. But also, one could argue that there's a kind of comic uplift to a film like Singing in the Rain. If you look at the current list, it's very serious films about the human condition or about the role of cinema in the human condition.
Yeah, in fact, I was, when I saw Singing in the Rain on the list, it wasn't on the top 10, I scratched my head a little bit. What is so great about Singing in the Rain?
Well, I think it has been on the list in previous decades. It's, again, people might differ about its aesthetic merits. Is it a great film? Is it an important film? I think, again, it goes back to what I was saying before. It's a film from the Hollywood studio system, but taking a certain ironic look at Hollywood. So it's as I said before, it's a meta film. It's not just a Hollywood film. It's commenting on the musical. It's commenting on the transition from silent film to sound. And many of the films on the list are films that are about cinema in one way or another. You know, Vertigo is at some level about a man obsessed by what he sees. And Hitchcock has often made films that are about the obsession of seeing. Some people have argued that another of his 50s films, Rear Window, is almost like it's about going to the cinema. Jeffries looks out his window, and it's like looking at a movie screen. He sees things. So one of the things critics have liked are films that are in some way about film, And to a certain degree, that's what Singing in the Rain is, or it's Hollywood looking at Hollywood.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dana Polan, professor of cinema studies at New York University. He voted in the last Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll a decade ago in 2002. We're talking about the new list that was just released a week or so ago. It's got a couple of surprises, including Vertigo being named the number one film, the greatest film of all time, knocking Citizen Kane off of that perch, at least this decade. And we just talked a little bit about Singing in the Rain. That's number 20 on the list. What do you think is the greatest film of all time? Let us know. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm happy again. I'm singing and dancing in the rain.
We are talking about the best movies of all time, according to Sight and Sound magazine. Number one on the list this year is Vertigo, followed by Citizen Kane, knocked off the top spot. But Psycho is on this list as well, number 35. So Alfred Hitchcock also has Psycho on the list of the greatest films of all time. What do you think belongs on this list? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine, and a few words about Psycho, Professor Polan. I always thought that I never got into the shower for a long time without, you know, being nervous since that film, but what else was great about that?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Psycho, because that's actually one of the three I would cite as my recommendations for important films that if you haven't seen them, you should. And I was surprised recently teaching a film class to discover that a number of my younger students hadn't seen Psycho, and a number didn't know the major twist in the narrative. So it is, even though I would have thought that Psycho was part of our common cultural vocabulary, there are a number of people for whom it is still a film to discover. And if I had to do a ranking, I would put it above Vertigo, not only in terms of its own aesthetic accomplishments, but of its place in film history. There's a very good book by a film critic named David Thompson called The Moment of Psycho, where he talks about how important Psycho is for a vast amount of cinema that came after it. It changes the way we think about narrative. It changes the way we think about violence. I find Psycho artistically a very close to perfect film, whereas as I was mentioning earlier, I see lots of aesthetic flaws in Vertigo. And Psycho, I think, is doing some interesting things with identification. It's doing some interesting things with what we think of as the Hollywood film. Here's a film with a major Hollywood star, Janet Leigh, and then it kills her off within the first 25 or so minutes.
Right.
I think it's very revolutionary in its own way.
You know, Alfred Hitchcock, we talked a little bit about him earlier. Are there certain directors who just make classic movies?
Well, I think if you look at the range of Hitchcock's career, it's an uneven career. There are some films that don't work. There are box office duds. There are failures, I think aesthetic failures. I recently saw his film I Confess, which is rising reputation, but I still see lots of problems in that film. So no director is perfect. Every director will have failures. Kubrick, whose Dr. Strangelove I esteem a lot, is a director who I think makes wrong steps with Eyes Wide Shut, although I have colleagues who think Eyes Wide Shut is an accomplishment. Again, it becomes very, very subjective.
Mm-hmm. Our next caller is Mike in Fifield. Hello, Mike.
Hello. I was wondering what Dr. Zhivago ended up on and War and Peace. Are they in the top 50?
Which War and Peace, the American or the Russian?
American.
The American. I don't think War and Peace makes it on there, has ever made it on there. Dr. Zhivago, I'm not sure. Again, Sight and Sound is a British publication. On the one hand, it wants to promote certain notions of British cinema. David Lean, who directed that film, is a kind of Sight and Sound darling earlier on in his career. But I think by the time of Dr. Zhivago, he's seen as repeating himself, making big, big films. I would bet that other of his films, I know that actually Brief Encounter, an early film of his, is on, I think, the 1952 poll. I would imagine that Lawrence of Arabia makes it on there more than Dr. Zhivago, but I must confess I'm not sure.
Yeah, on the 50 that I have in front of me, no, Dr. Zhivago did not.
Is Lawrence of Arabia on there? I don't have that list in front of me.
Well, I don't think it is. No, I don't think it is. So we'll, nope.
Okay.
Our next caller is Mark in Milwaukee. Hello, Mark.
Yes, good morning, guys. This is what I'm going to say. Symbiopsychotaxiplasm, take one, directed by William Greaves.
And why is whatever that is a good one?
Yeah, well, Symbiopsychotaxiplasm, one. It's I believe it's from 68. It's color 16mm, shot in Central Park. Talk about metafilm. And this does not have the oblique veil of metaphor about film about film. It's these filmmakers making an experimental film in the park, and you use cliched attributes such as lyrical and poetic. Well, you can heap those on that film.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've not seen the film, and that already may say something about a film needs to be available to a wide range of critics. I mean, 800 critics voted in the current poll. It needs to be seen by a lot of people to get on the list. But it also suggests something else about the list, which is it is geared toward the feature film. Again, when it included more silent films, some shorter films got on there. One could debate whether on the current list Dziga Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera is a feature film or not. But for the most part, it's not about short film, it's not about experimental film, it's not about avant-garde film. It's about narrative cinema.
Yeah, and documentaries aren't on there either.
Although they had been in the past.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mark. Dave in Greendale is with us now. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. What's your nomination?
Easily Outlaw Josie Wales. Clint Eastwood, my favorite director, but also my favorite actor. And just a fantastic Western, very well-rounded. And there's nothing like a Clint Eastwood Western, in my opinion. I think they, hands down, are the best Westerns from a costume standpoint and a Just the whole spectrum of the genre.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know if there is a Western on here. There might be. I can look. But what do you think of that?
The Searchers is on there. And that,
okay,
sort of counts, although it's kind of an ironic anti-Western or an undoing of the classic Western, as are many of the Clint Eastwood films. You know, and again, I would say that something that the caller said was like one of the previous callers, the one who called in about The Empire Strikes Back, who had said it has everything for a science fiction fan. Here the caller said there's nothing like a Clint Eastwood movie, and then compared other Westerns to it. So if that's the factors that for you define a great film, clearly this film is going to fit that. And The Outlaw Josie Wales is an incredibly well-made film. It's incredibly well-crafted. It is, I think, a fine film, and it really is a fine film within the genre of the Western and redefines the Western in important ways.
You know, my husband's favorite Western, and I would say one of his favorite movies of all time, one of the few that we actually have in our library, is related to our next caller. So let me bring Charles and Madison on next. Hello, Charles.
Good morning, Joy. Excuse me. I would say my favorite film has to be Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa. Such an epic movie, and also look at all the Westerns and the spaghetti Westerns that really took Kurosawa's vision and just switched over from a samurai to the gunslinger. Just wondering if your guest had a comment on Kurosawa.
Yeah, and by the way, That Seventh Samurai is on the list. What number is it? It's number 17.
Right. I think one of the interesting things about, it's a great comments from Charles. Some things about Seventh Samurai, I think one of the things that doesn't help it get onto the top 10 is that there's another Kurosawa within the top 10, or maybe not in the current list. I guess Rashomon dropped out, but there is Ozu's Tokyo Story. And I think several things happened. One is, I was mentioning before that the poll skews sort of anti-Hollywood. It also skews very much towards a kind of European art cinema, or when Asian films make it on, they are sort of Asian art films that show in Western festivals. So, for example, Rashomon, which was on the list for a very long time, was a big favorite at things like the Venice Film Festival in the 1950s. So there's very little room on the list, or there's very little room made for or given to films outside a kind of Western European circuit. There's no Latin American cinema. There's no African cinema. There's very little Asian cinema. So it's very hard for something to place. And I think the sense is we put in our token Asian film. We don't have room for another one in the top 10. So if Rashomon is on the list, as it had been for a long time, Seven Samurai won't get on. If Tokyo Story is now on, other Asian films wouldn't get on. Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love, which is also a kind of art cinema favorite, is on the list, but I think in the second, not in the top 10, but somewhere further down.
Yeah, and our caller certainly alluded to it. The Magnificent Seven is my husband's, one of his favorite movies, and that's directly taken from Seven Samurai, right?
Yes, yeah, and I was talking before about one of the criteria for a great film might be a film that's influenced others, and in that respect, Seven Samurai, like The Searchers, has influenced a whole series of films after it, very much borrowing its narrative to do their own things. And The Magnificent Seven is a fascinating film. I have a great fondness for the films of John Sturges, so I would applaud your husband's choice.
Yes. Chris in Oshkosh is with us now. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I went to see the movie The Artist, which isn't normally the kind of film I would go to see, but I thought it was an absolute masterpiece. I was particularly taken aback by the behavior of the audience and in the theater and how engrossed they were in the film. And I'm just curious, from your guest perspective, is that the kind of movie that would show up on this list at some point? And how long does it take for movies to, I would assume there's some sort of a gap in time that they don't make this list right away.
Good question.
I think there's a series of great questions there. One is about the gap in time. And as I mentioned before, the gap was shorter in the first decades of the poll. So a film that had come out only a couple years earlier could make it on the list. I think increasingly there's the sense that we need to wait and see how things play out, see if a film maintains its reputation. The example cited was Inception, which was a very big film for a certain age group and I think will not date well and will not look as important both to that audience when they get older, but to film history. The Artist is a hard one for me. It's not a film that I personally like, and again, you know, the caller and I could have an important debate about it, and I think that's what's great about these kinds of suggestions, is when you can debate. Part of my worry with lists, like the Sight and Sound list, is that it becomes a dogma. It's sort of accept this list or else, or there's something wrong with you.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dana Poland, professor of cinema studies at New York University. He voted in the Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll in 2002. We have time for a couple of more calls before our Thursday 3 segment. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. Thank you. I wanted to mention two movies that I think are really, really, really good, and they are Au Revoir les Enfants and then the Chinese movie Raise the Red Lantern. And they seem real similar to me because they both are very, very subtle, and they tell a really significant, relevant story to, you know, that's universal, but they do it by focusing on a specific time and a specific event. And I just think that they're so understated and yet so important. And I wonder what you think.
Well, I'm sorry, but I didn't hear the first title you cited.
Au revoir les enfants, Louis Malle.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think both those films are, I would again say, are very important films, and I'm glad you appreciate them. I think for the case of the Chinese film, I already mentioned that it's hard for diversity to enter the list, including geographic diversity. It is a very European-centric list, but that's a film that one should esteem. And the Louis Malle is also an incredibly important film. I think one of the things we see over the decades is French film by the New Wave directors, whether it be Godard or Louis Malle or Claude Chabrol or François Truffaut, those films have dropped out. They're not as represented as they once were.
Today we are going to ask our guest film expert to recommend three films that we ought to see. Maybe films that aren't on this list of the greatest films of all time, but we will ask Dana Polan, our professor of cinema studies at New York University, to leave us with three films that we may want to see. Professor Polan, what three movies do you recommend for our listeners to see?
Okay. Well, thinking about it and having cited Psycho earlier, I think I'm going to actually change my list and suggest three other films.
Okay.
Two of which I'm sure I suggested to Sight and Sound in 2002 when they actually rejected my list. One is Jules and Jim, the François Truffaut film from 1962, which is actually the film that got me first interested in studying or thinking about cinema. It's an incredibly inventive film, uses all the resources of cinema. It has fascinating subject matter about romance, about interpersonal relationship. I think it's a film that just radiates love of cinema from beginning to end. So one would be Jules and Jim. And maybe surprisingly, but maybe this also fits with your husband's interest in The Magnificent Seven, I might put on the list my personal favorite for an entertainment film, the John Sturges film, The Great Escape, which I think is both a wonderful accomplishment as an action film, but it's also a film that is beginning to move the action film in important moral directions. It's raising questions. Was it all worth it? One of the characters asks at the end of the film after the escape has sort of failed. I think it's also an interesting film at the cusp of the old Hollywood and new 60s cinema. So I find that a very, very interesting film. And then the film I did recommend to Sight and Sound as my favorite, the film that I thought had made me think about cinema in important ways and had kind of enduring power, is a 1949 film noir crime film called Gun Crazy. It's a low-budget B-movie directed by a man named Joseph H. Lewis. And even though it's made with limited resources, it's incredibly inventive. It expands the things you can do in storytelling through cinema. It's wonderfully acted, and it's got a wonderful sense of romance, of how people interact. It's a beautiful story, very poignant, and I think is a wonderful example of cinema.
Well, this has been a really interesting hour. I'm going to put your three on my to-do list. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dana Polan, professor of cinema studies at New York University. We will, by the way, write up his recommendations and post them on our website and the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And you can also see on our website and Facebook page the list of the greatest films of all time, according to Sight and Sound magazine. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing and directing this hour, and to Bill Martins for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.